everybody, and welcome to this episode of Frank About Health. If you recall, last week we were approaching the topic of diabetes, but today we're going to talk about diabetes type 1 with our special guest today, Margaret Peggy Pellizzari, who goes by Peggy, and my co-host, Dr. Phyllis Quinlan, where we're going to really have an opportunity to speak to an individual living with the disease since age 13, but has really made a quality of life out of living with this condition, and at the same time making herself into an advocate for those living with it, as well as being a nurse that has been managing people in the profession, such as nurses and social workers. And so we're going to have a very nice in-depth story about an individual living with the disease and advocating. And for that reason, I'd like to welcome you to Frank About Health, Peggy. And by all means, let's talk about your story.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. Frank, I've been waiting for this for a long time. I've known Peggy for a long time. Mm-hmm. She's fabulous. And could I take a few minutes just to talk about her credentials?
Absolutely.
So I'm only going to talk about a couple of her credentials, or we'd eat up all the time. Peggy has a dual master's from Adelphi University in nursing administration as well as business administration. She's certified by the American Nurses Association. She's board certified as a nurse executive, and she is a certified diabetic care and education specialist. She has been a nurse for a number of years, and she's currently holding a patient care manager or associate manager position with one of the larger healthcare systems here in the New York area. Mm-hmm. She's been published several times. She has a piece in the Journal of Diabetes Science and Technology. She has another piece in a journal entitled Diabetic Care, and she's also published in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrine and Endocrinology and Metabolism.
Amazing.
She has a lot of professional associations or professional association leadership positions. She is the past chair of the New York State Association of Diabetes Care and Education Specialists. She's also a past president of the Metropolitan Chapter of Diabetic Educators. And in 2016, she did receive the Pediatric Advocate of the Year Award from the Metropolitan New York American Association of Diabetic Educators. And I'm telling you, I am just gleaming, or, you know, just skimming over her resume as I'm sharing this with you.
I can imagine. I mean, when you forwarded to me her background, I literally saw her on many different facets. I think we even talked about a two-hour show, maybe. But we were being mindful of what is going to be most appropriate and most concise, especially since we're also here to educate the listeners and viewers about diabetes type 1.
Yeah.
But at the same time, to take a case in point, which is Peggy, to show how she has really taken that condition and made it into her life's work and really advocated not only for those living with it, but advocating it, I would have to say, as a lifestyle or a way of turning a lemon into lemonade in this case. And there's probably a much better way to say it than I've just done it. So from that perspective, Peggy, would you like to tell us your own story about when you were diagnosed, as well as what you went through psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, how you used your own skill set as being a nurse and even in the healthcare profession to actually help fight for it or research it? By all means, just share with the listeners and viewers how you've dealt with it once you were diagnosed.
Oh, my pleasure. So I was age 13 when I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And we didn't know actually that it was diabetes. I was sick for around 2 weeks, drinking a lot, peeing a lot. My parents took me to several doctors, and they missed the diagnosis until one of the pediatricians said, "What, we need you to pee in the cup." And they checked for glucose and sent me straight away to the hospital. So it came as a shock. It was a shock because nobody in my family has type 1 diabetes that we know of. One of my cousins, aunts and uncles. So nobody had it. And I'm one of four children. So it came as a shock to us. And the whole education piece of the nutrition component, as well as the medication component, which is going to be insulin and insulin right. for life until there becomes a cure, was a big learning curve for all of us. Now, being the age of 13, I wanted to take it on myself. And so I, since diagnosis, have been doing my own insulin administration. And at that time, about 44 years ago, there were no insulin pens. There was no meters to check for the sugar. The insulin came from a cow or a pig, and it was like two injections a day of this kind of insulin. And so we didn't know what our glucose was. You had to check the urine. And it was like doing a little science experiment where you peed in the cup and you took this huge tablet and did it in a tube and watched it. We felt like it's alka-seltzer. And it came out of colors. 1+, 2+, 3+, or 4+, and 4+ was like the most sugar. And then to check for ketones, which is a serious condition, meaning that you wouldn't have enough insulin, it was also another little science experiment where it was this little tablet and you had to put the urine in the little dropper and drop it on the tablet and put the clock on to see what those values were. And that had to be done every day. And then it was in the 1970s that the checking for blood sugar came about for home monitoring for right. glucose checks. And you had to have like good insurance to be able to have these supplies. Mm-hmm. And those meters, those first meters were like the size of a huge woman's wallet. And you needed a lot of blood. And the Lansing device to check for the sugar reminded me of kind of like a guillotine. So it's like, it went like this, that you actually saw the lancet and you would go like, boom. And it would just like,
wow.
bash into your finger like that. Well, that wasn't appealing at all for anybody to want to do that. No. And everybody would be like, wow, isn't that great? Now you know what your sugar is. And I'm just like, this doesn't seem that great to me. This thing is like, I'm seeing it and it hurts. Like, what about this?
Exactly.
Peggy.
Yes?
I'm sorry. Just at 13, when everybody's trying to, you know, you're 13, you're blossoming, you're having body image issues that go with teenagers, you know, becoming a teenager, you want to fit in, you want to be like everybody else, but you want to be yourself. You know the struggles of you know, going through that kind of a period in your life. I mean, how did you manage that? And was that part of why you decided to go into pediatric nursing?
So what's interesting is that at 13, at that time that I got diagnosed, was the summer right before I started high school. So there were a lot of things going on. Like, I didn't know anybody going to my high school. And I grew up in Queens. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of hush-hush. So my diabetes and my care and my insulin injections, it was done like twice a day. It was done at home. So it was hush hush. And I didn't really speak to anybody about it. It wasn't really until college. In college that, you know, in learning about nursing and learning about diabetes as well and transitioning from pediatric care to adult care, where I was becoming more of like who's Peggy and what Peggy's going to do in her life,
right.
that I was able to get a little more direction. And I got to give a lot of credit to my mom, who said, like, Peg, what are you going to do with your life? And I'm just like, well, I want to be an actress and a dancer. And she's like, no. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You say no. If you ask any of my friends, they're not really sure what they want to be. And I'm telling you, I want to be an actress and a dancer. And she's like, you have diabetes and you need to get a job where you're going to have good medical insurance to cover for, you know, the best care that you can get. And I was like, wow, that bubble got burst quite quickly. And I have to think about this. And so she made the suggestion, well, why don't you be like maybe a nutritionist or a nurse? And those are very solid fields. And I'm just like, okay. I'm going to be a nurse. There we go. That's it. And that's how I decided to be a nurse at age 20. And at that time, when I was transitioning, now going to adult care and going to the visits by myself, one of the nurses who were there, the diabetes educators, also had type 1 diabetes. And she disclosed it to me because all through these other years, I did not know anybody who had type 1 diabetes. So it was very lonely to not be able to talk to anybody. Nobody understood what it was like, what I was going through. And so I was like, wow, now I have like kind of like role model of what I want to be, what I think I should be, you know, one day.
So when you were first diagnosed at age 13, did you even have any symptoms or anything to indicate that you needed to be tested for it? Or was it just during a physical exam?
Oh, no. I was 2 weeks sick with drinking a lot, peeing a lot, and losing weight. And okay. It wasn't
for no explained reason. For no explained reason. So you saw it medically.
For no explained reason, yes.
I see. And I guess your mom, being a nurse, pretty much thought, okay, we got to have you checked out at the doctor's office.
Neither one of my parents are in the medical field. They just knew that, like, I wasn't looking well. I wasn't feeling well. They took me to doctors. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I lost maybe 20 pounds, and they were very, very concerned.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, so, and they're concerned, like, you know, why am I getting sicker and sicker? You know,
when you got the diagnosis at age 13 that it was diabetes, did you even have a clue what they were saying to you?
No.
It must have been overwhelming to receive that diagnosis at that time, right?
Absolutely. But I didn't know. I was just told, okay, you got to do this, that, and the other thing. I'm like, okay, so I'll do this, that, and the other thing. Until I wanted to be a little rebellious teenager and said, well, I also want to eat devil dogs just like everybody else.
Yes. Peggy, how did you use that experience, that really, you know, traumatic moment, life-changing moment in your life? How do you use that now in your practice? Because I know you are working in an ambulatory pediatric care center for endocrine. And, you know, many of the children that you are caring for are coming in newly diagnosed with diabetes. How do you help them come to grips in such a practical, accepting way as you did?
Well, I think what's important, because when we're working with pediatrics, we're working also with the family. We're working with whether it's parents and grandparents, whether it's the siblings involved in the care. And I've learned that disclosing that I've been living with type 1 diabetes for X amount of years really helps these families to sometimes they do like a double take, like, what did you just say? It's like, yes, I have type 1 diabetes since this many years. And like, and they'll be like, oh, well, you look okay. And I'm like, yes, thank you very much. I am okay. And your child will also be okay. And you will all be okay. But there are certain things that need to be done on a day-to-day basis in order for individuals living with type 1 diabetes to be healthy and feel healthy.
Right.
And that initial education process takes several hours. We're here for you. We're here for you, and we're going to get through all of this education process so that you have a better understanding of how you can take care of your child.
Well, we're about to head.
Go ahead. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. It's okay. We're about to head to our first break. But when we come back, I want you to explain, for example, how you give people the understanding once they find out that you have type 1 diabetes, how you're able to bring them into the circle of understanding as to if, for example, they have a child that has the disorder, how they can learn about it, how they can enhance their quality of life, so forth and so on. So we'll be right back right here in a couple minutes on Frank About Health, right here on talkradio.nyc and Facebook Live, with our guest, Peggy Pelizzari, and of course, co-host, Dr. Phyllis Quinlan, right here. See you soon.
Are you a business owner? Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you on edge? Hey, we live in challenging, edgy times, so let's lean in. I'm Sandra Bargeman, the host of The Edge of Every Day, which airs each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc. Tune in live with me and my friends and colleagues as we share stories and perspectives about pushing boundaries and exploring our rough edges. That's The Edge of Every Day on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Everybody, welcome back to Frank About Health. Peggy, before the break, we were talking about how that as people find out that you have been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes or that you've been living with it, they pretty much enter a circle of trust with you, and they're able to share what their own experience is, especially if they have a child or even they themselves have the disease. Can you explain a little bit about how you're able to engage with them and even describe what you tell them in terms of treatment protocol or symptoms to watch out for or anything like that?
Sure. So so we talk about, you know, what it entails to live with type 1 diabetes, and what it entails is several things. One is going to be the administration of insulin, and it's daily injections a day. So there's a long-acting insulin that's called like a basal insulin that's going to cover the amount of insulin an individual needs just to, like, basically, you know, sit up and breathe, you know. So that's their baseline insulin. And then they're going to need what's called bolus insulin. So that's the insulin before they eat, covering their amount of carbohydrates, as well as an opportunity to correct a high sugar. And these doses of the bolus insulin is a weight-based medication, so they're going to get what's called like a carbohydrate ratio and a correction factor and a target glucose. Now, the hardest part probably for many of these individuals is doing the math. So there are several apps that we can use on the phone to help with the calculations of the math. And then the other component is the carbohydrate counting piece. So let's say somebody's going to eat a sandwich for lunch, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're going to look on the package of bread for the serving size of the bread, right? So, okay, one piece of bread has, let's say, 15 grams of carbohydrates. So if they have two slices of bread, that would be 30 grams of carbohydrates. If they have, you look on the milk carton, if they have a cup of milk, so they'll have to measure the cup of milk. So if they have a cup of milk, that equals 12 grams of carbohydrates. So when you add all of those up, that's 15 and 15 and 12 is 42. And then let's say they had a carbohydrate ratio of, they need one unit of the fast-acting insulin for, let's say, 10 grams of carbohydrate, just for easy math. So for that meal, they need 4.2 units.
Wow.
So, and then if their sugar is high, let's say their target number is 120. And let's say their sugar before the meal is 180. And their correction factor, they need one unit to lower them by 50 points of sugar to a target of 130. So they'll take the 180 minus 130, whatever that number is, which actually happens to be 50 because I'm doing the easy math for my MBA to use there, divided by the 50, which is the correction factor, gives them one unit. So they're going to add that one unit of a correction plus the 4.2 gives them 5.2. And on an insulin pen, you can either do whole units or the half units. So they would round down to the nearest heavy unit, which would then give them 5 units. So it's more like it's a lot of thought process going on. They got to think about how many carbs they're having. If they're having an apple, I mean, you got to weigh the apple to see how many grams of carbohydrate are in an apple. Because, you know, you got small apples, you got big apples.
Yes.
they can basically eat anything that's, you know, healthy. Like any prudent individual should be eating, right? Healthy eating. And we stay away from sugary beverages. So like water, seltzer, things like that are acceptable.
Peggy.
So there's that component of that.
Yeah. I you're a specialist in endocrinology and pediatrics. And of course, my clinical background is critical care emergency trauma. So my experience with diabetes is usually when diabetes has gone amiss and we're now in perhaps a diabetic coma. But my question to you is this. I understood exactly what you said about the calculations and everything and reading the labels and all of that. How do you look a mom and a child in the face and they're coming up with a new diagnosis of diabetes? And as they're listening to some of this, how do you help them get past the thought that my life is over or my life will never be the same or diabetes is now my life, and get them past that to remember that they are a person living with diabetes and, you know, that diabetes doesn't have them? And, you know, what is the body, mind, and spirit piece that you offer them? Because I know you travel all over the place. You're always going away on weekends. You are one active gal that's involved in life. I know that you fed your actress and dancing gene, even though mom said don't do it. I know you did. You know, so how, you know, with all of that, you know, 360 degrees of life that you are living, how in those first few moments and days and weeks and months, how do you help that mother and that child transition?
Right.
So you know, you got to snooze a little bit, you know, so I want to learn more about what their life is like before this diagnosis. You know, what does this child like to do? Mm-hmm. Who's the support system in the family? Who's working? Who's not working? The child's in school. What about after school? You got to figure all of these components out. Are they in activities? What kind of activities? So that this way I'm going to be able to address how are we going to, because I'm a mom also. Mm-hmm. Know how moms think and how working moms think if they got to go, you know, they got to get to work too. And who's going to watch their child? Right. So going to pinpoint all of the aspects of that individual family's life so that they know, okay, you do karate, you can still do karate. You play soccer, you can still play soccer. You're a swimmer, you can still swim. You like to eat, you eat peanut butter and jelly? No problem. You like pancakes with syrup? Well, let's address the syrup business because that might mess up your sugars. But what about, would you make a compromise and do syrup and butter or maybe some sugar-free syrup with your pancakes? You know, let's talk about that. So that it's really like, I don't want to mess up so much their structure that they have.
Right.
So want to try to address the structure that they have and incorporate the new things that they're going to have to change and think about, which is knowing what those sugars are, incorporating the carbs that they're consuming so that we can now, you know, address the insulin dosing with the carbohydrate count. Mm-hmm. Talking about the activity and that they can still continue to do those activity. You know, oh, we're going to go away. We want to go away. Definitely you should go away. You're going to go through the airport. We're going to write a travel letter to go through airport security. Carry all your diabetes supplies and everything on your carry-on. You don't check that in. You know, those kinds of things that we, yes, we're going to support all of that stuff.
Right.
So they don't feel like, you know, it's a loss. It is, because honestly, it is a loss. It is a loss. You know, when you think about the stages of grief and everything, the freedom of being able to just eat whatever you want, whenever you want to eat it, is now taken away.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's whisked away just like that. Now it's like, wow, like I got to do like so much thinking just to eat.
But at the same time, what you've done by engaging with them and having the trust, especially of the parent who's probably watching their child be diagnosed with type 1, is you are all of a sudden integrating into their family structure so that you can help re-educate, you know, what they can compensate for the losses of freedom that they now have, or basically how to look at it as like an everyday work project, science project, as you kind of called it, science experiment, but at least knowing that they're going to have a higher quality of life than they probably wouldn't have had if they never even met you after they were diagnosed, correct?
It's a huge learning curve. And I think, you know, a lot of times they're exhausted, especially if the kids were, you know, sick for a while and or in diabetic ketoacidosis and ended up in the intensive care unit. I mean, it's very traumatic. It's very emotional. So we're seeing them at their toughest moments sometimes. And sometimes we just need to, you know, give them hugs. You know, it's like, you got this, give them coffee. Yeah. Thank goodness for those Keurig machines in the office. Give them some coffee and just be very respectful that they're allowing us in their lives at this very vulnerable time.
Right.
And it's an honor to be able to help these families to get through a very tough time. And for the children, to help them, you know, I remember, you know, sometimes they hide under the table because they don't want to have an insulin injection. And I'm like, well, I don't blame them. Because if anybody is like super volunteering for this, I mean, that's kind of weird also. So I think it's just really, you know, keeping it very individual and being very supportive and understanding and kind and compassionate.
Right. Well, we're about to take another break, but I did want to say when we return, I want you to explain what is the percentage of those people living, those children, I gather predominantly children are who you're dealing with. So what percentage of them are at the diagnosis stage, or they're just learning how to measure their insulin and do these calculations? And what percentage are at the risk factor stage for some of the side effects, like sometimes there's numbness in the foot. I forgot the disorder they call that.
Neuropathy.
Thank you. I want to learn more about that when we return right here, as we are being frank about diabetes type 1 with both our guest Peggy Pellizzari and my co-host Dr. Phyllis Quinlan. We'll be back in a few.
Howdy, I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
Passionate about the conversation around racism? Hi, I'm Reverend Dr. TLC, host of the Dismantle Racism Show, which airs every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc. Join me and my amazing guests as we discuss ways to uncover, dismantle, and eradicate racism. That's Thursdays at 11 o'clock a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a small business trying to navigate the COVID-19 related employment laws? Hello, I'm Eric Sauver, employment law business law attorney and host of the new radio show, Employment Law Today. On my show, we'll have guests to discuss the common employment law challenges business owners are facing during these trying times. Tune in on Tuesday evenings from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Everybody, welcome back. So, Peggy, as we went into the break, I was asking you, what percentage of pediatric cases of diabetes type 1 are at the point of the side effects that come with it, or at what percentage are just those that have been diagnosed and are going through the regimen of learning how to measure their insulin and measure their carbohydrate intake and things like that?
Sure. So we have a fairly large diabetes practice with about close to 800 individuals with type 1 diabetes, and that's both type 1 and type 2. We see maybe 100 to, in COVID year, we saw like 180 new diagnosed a year. Now, it's more rare to see any type of diabetes complications in the pediatric population. We do have some individuals who have protein in the urine, and they're followed very, very closely by the kidney specialists, and there's a medication that they can take to help prevent further kidney damage. And the key is keeping the glucoses and the A1C, which is a test that's done every 2 to 3 months to see how is the average glucose is doing. So we don't see that many individuals who have complications. And what has helped really is the diabetes technologies throughout the last 10 years. So I would really like to talk about those diabetes technologies.
Absolutely.
So, you know, coming from, you know, when I was diagnosed 44 years ago and just being on 2 injections a day of either beef or cow insulin, now the insulins are more sophisticated. And now most individuals, when they need type 1 diabetes, are on, you know, insulin before meals, before snacks, and at bedtime. So we're talking anywhere from like 4 to 6 injections a day. Or the other alternative would be to go on an insulin pump. So I've been on an insulin pump for about 36, 37 years. So I was in my early 20s when I went on my first insulin pump. So an insulin pump is just a different way to get your insulin delivery. So you wear your pump all the time. You wear it when you're sleeping. Some pumps, there's pumps that would have tubing, and then there's some insulin pumps, an insulin pump that has no tubing. So it's a different way to get it. It's still work that you've got to, you know, bolus for your insulin, which really means pushing a button to get that delivery of insulin before you eat and inputting those carbs. So carb counting is still an extremely important part of diabetes management. And the other thing in diabetes technology that has really been revolutionized is this idea of continuous glucose monitoring systems. So you see there's a lot of commercials on this. It's like the Abbott Freestyle Libre 2, and there's the Dexcom G6. So these, and there's Medtronic also has a standalone continuous glucose monitoring system. There's an implantable glucose monitoring system, but that's approved for ages 18 and above. Excuse me. And so with the advent of these continuous glucose monitoring system and the reports, you can see how much time, it's called time in range, of somebody's sugars between a value of 70 and 180. And then that can equate of what one's A1C will be like in 2 to 3 months. So continuous means like it's taking readings every 1 to 5 minutes. That's number one. And number two, a lot of them are replacing finger stick testing. So this is, it's a device that's worn on your body. It gets changed, you know, it depends on the manufacturer, every 10 days, every 14 days, every 7 days. And that's, and then the other thing with these continuous glucose monitoring systems, especially working in pediatrics, is that the kid could be at school, the readings could be on the kid's phones, and then the parents can also have those readings in real time on their phone.
Very nice.
So the other thing is that the insulin pumps, some of them are now integrated with continuous glucose monitoring system. And with this integration and very sophisticated algorithms, now the insulin pumps insulin delivery system is being driven to some degree by the continuous glucose monitoring system itself. And what that means is that there's a lot less burden on the individual living with diabetes, and to so that these systems help to keep more time in range. So that's very important. The downside to it is that you've got two things on your body. You've got a continuous glucose monitoring system on your body, and you've got an insulin pump on your body. Right. And you've got to be okay with wearing these two things on your body. Right. That's number one. Number two, there are alarms. So the alarms are going to alert you if your sugars are low or if it's an urgent low. And they're going to alert you if your sugar's high. Hmm. Well, these are good things. Somebody would on the outside might say, wow, well, that's really good, right? And the answer is, yes, it is really good. But to another degree, it's like, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot of beeping going on sometimes, you know? And, you know, I just remember like being out somewhere and then you're beeping and then people are looking around like, what's that beep? Now, if I don't want anybody to know that I'm beeping, I'm going to look around just like they are. I'm going to be like, I don't know, what's that beep? Meanwhile, it's me. I just don't want them to know I'm beeping.
Peggy, what I'm hearing you share, and it's so heartfelt and so human, I really have to embrace your transparency here.
Yes.
But what I'm hearing you share is, number one, what we've learned in the technology that you just described so well, what that allows us to do is monitor glucoses very, very tightly and very, very closely. And if I'm understanding you correctly, that is the key to keeping the long-term side effects in check, so that you're the annoyance of wearing two things on your body and perhaps beeping inadvertently is really saving you from some very dire long-term consequences that people associate with, you know, diabetes type one that's not well managed or is what we call brittle and very difficult to manage. And it sounds to me also, if I have this right, that the insulin pump and the glucose monitoring device you described is almost, it's as close to a pancreas as, you know, definitely mechanical or digital, but it's as close to a pancreas as we have right now. Am I right? Or do I understand you correctly?
That's exactly what I picked up.
Yeah, these hybrid closed loop systems, that are FDA approved, that's where it's going. It is still work. You know, individuals on these systems still need to, you know, count their carbs and push the buttons on their pump to deliver a bolus of insulin. And even before FDA approved some of these devices, there was a movement called We're Not Waiting. So in the community of type 1 diabetes, in this community of We're Not Waiting, individuals have learned how to hack into some systems to build a system called DIY, or do it yourself, to be able to formulate an advanced hybrid closed loop system, because they're looking to have better control or the best control of these sugars as possible.
Now,
so people who are, you know, really looking to take care of their diabetes want to be on these systems. They not that, that we're happy to wear two things on our body, but they it's better place to have sugars and better control than to not feel good with high sugars or uncontrolled sugars.
Right.
And also, like, I think what you said is that these new technologies are also taking away what had been historically the common pricking of the finger and then the actual manual injection of the insulin, which probably was in itself life-altering. You know, this is more making it seamless, correct?
It's work. It's still work.
Less painful, but it's still work.
I wish, you know, if you ask me, I was like, I wish I didn't have diabetes, right? You know, but if we're talking about, you know, what's the reality of things? Hey, listen, the other day, my pump site was bothering me. And well, it's not supposed to bother you if it's in and everything's okay. So I had to change it. But, you know, it's like, I also got to get out to work. But I couldn't not change it at that given moment and drive 40 minutes to get into work. And then by the time I settle, you know, an hour's gone by like that. I had to do that no matter what, because this is my lifeline. I have type 1 diabetes and this is my lifeline. This is serious. Mm-hmm. So nothing is more important. And I would say to, like, you know, my family, I'll knock on some wood, you know, like if I'm thinking about how many carbs I got to eat or I got to change my pump site or whatever, I mean, unless there's like some catastrophe going on, nothing is really more important than me taking care of this. And then I'm all yours after.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, true.
I guess then what was it? Well, we're about to take a 2 minute. I mean, we're about to have a break in a couple minutes. But when we return, I want to say, are watching the new technologies, watching everyone change their lifestyle once they've been diagnosed with type one and experiencing it yourself as a patient, is that what made you become more of an advocate from any articles you've contributed, the various organizations that Phyllis listed that you're involved with? I want to hear more about that. And if what you've been seeing and what you just described over the last 10 or few minutes, if that drove you to become more of an advocate on all of this. So ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned as we ponder those questions right here on Frank About Health, as we talk more about Peggy and her advocacy work with type 1 diabetes. Right here on talkradio.nyc and Facebook Live. Stay tuned.
Join us every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern for The Mind Behind Leadership, where we focus on what leadership really means to us and to others. We have practical discussions with the CEOs of some of the world's largest companies, owners of small businesses, and experts in psychology and behavior to get that inside track, what to do, what to avoid, and what really happens. Join me, Graham Dobbin, at the new time, 4 p.m. every Tuesday for The Mind Behind Leadership here live on talkradio.nyc.
Hey, everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on talkradio.nyc.
Calling all pet lovers.
Pet Avengers, assemble!
On the Professionals and Animal Lovers show, we believe the bond between animal lovers is incredibly strong. It mirrors that bond between pets and their owners. Through this program, we come together to learn, educate, and advocate.
Join us live every Wednesday at 2 p.m. at talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Everybody, and welcome back to this episode of Frank About Health. Peggy, so all of the stories that you just shared about the new technologies, about that it's a lot of work to deal, your own experience in having to replace your pump while you also had to go to work, this must have turned you into an advocate, whether you've contributed to organizations that are in the field. Can you share about that? I mean, your resume in itself already says that. So I'd like to know more specifics.
Absolutely. So in my practice, we have what's called an American Diabetes Association recognized education program. Mm. And so we have very strong ties to the American Diabetes Association. And I have been the Long Island advocacy chair for the American Diabetes Association for several years and have gone to lobby up in Albany for right now. What's a hot topic is like the pricing of insulin was right. just actually in the paper the other day. Mm-hmm. The other groups that I'm very, very involved with is the Diabetes Research Institute Foundation and the Juvenile Diabetes Research JDRF, Diabetes Research Foundation. Mm-hmm. So these are all organizations that support diabetes care and education, research, advocacy, and, you know, for a cure as well. And whether it's diabetes walks, whether it's the Safe at School programs. So we'll talk about, let's talk about Safe at School. So, right. you know, so I work in pediatrics and the kids, you know, by law, they need to be in school. Some of the challenges are, let's say we have preschoolers. We have, you know, we have children who are less than 1 year old get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
Wow.
We have babies who are breastfeeding, so it's very hard to do carb counting on you know, a breastfeeding baby. You know, you have challenges of, you know, toddlers who are picky eaters. You have kids in school who, I mean, right now during COVID, not really going on field trips, but right. there have been in the past where they were told, well, you can't go on the field trip. And I'm like, what? You go to a public school where it is federally funded and there is a nurse and they're telling you that if your mom can't go or somebody can't go on the field trip, you have to stay back. I'm like, well, I'm going to make a phone call and I am going to use the word that this is illegal. This is not okay. This is discrimination. You can. So diabetes is actually a disability of the endocrine system. So under the American with Disabilities Act and under Section 504 with reasonable accommodations, you know, whether it's places of work or in school, that they need to make reasonable accommodations for these children. And if the whole class is going on the field trip, then it's the school's responsibility to find somebody who's going to be able to take care of their child. Mm-hmm. If the child is not able to do self-care for right. their diabetes management. So there have been phone calls made for those kinds of things. Or let's say, you know, one of the kids is eating lunch with the school nurse. I'm like, why? The kid was from Shore wants to eat with their friends. So what's, you know, help me understand what's going on here, you know, right. and it's really to have, you know, a relationship with the parents, you know, because the parents are leaving the kids at school for all these amount of hours and they've got to have a good relationship with the school nurse. We need to have a good relationship with the school nurse because the school nurses many times are letting us know when the kids' sugars are high so that this way then we can report that and have a conversation with the parents. Oh, do we need to make insulin adjustments because the school nurse is saying these are what the sugars have been at school. So there's a lot of communication about, you know, and relationships that are formed mm-hmm. For helping these children, for helping individuals, for on the advocacy piece, and all around on the research piece of trying to come up with a cure for diabetes and funding for a cure and funding for better management. All of these things are all very good things and very, very dear to my heart because
right.
I live with it.
Right.
I live with it. I work with these families. I feel their pain when the insurance company says, well, we're going to switch your insurance because we're not going to cover this insulin this year. We're going to cover this insulin, you know? So if they need half unit pen devices and that's not their formulary, well, now my office is going to have to call to do a prior authorization for that, but we'll do that. Or if there's, well, your child hasn't had diabetes for more than 6 months, so we're not going to pay for an insulin pump. it doesn't make any sense. So I'm gonna write the letter of medical necessity and have the doctor review it, so that we can advocate for this child who would do much better on an insulin pump rather than the injections, you know, because
so things aren't hard enough, Peg, right? things aren't hard enough that you have to wear a glucose monitor device and a pump. But, you know, now you have to make sure the school is doing the right thing and the legal thing. You need to make sure you stay in contact with the school nurse. And now you have to stay on top of insurance companies who are making arbitrary decisions based on finance, not on wellness outcomes, which right. is really what we're paying for, based on finance. And it could be disruptive to your life on top of something that can already be challenging to navigate. So, you know, how is it that you keep these families, you know, their body, mind, and spirit intact? You know, I'm sitting here in awe of what you do, because, you know, we talk about holistic approaches to well-being.
Yes.
You know, when you're out there advocating for schools and field trips, and you're arm wrestling on behalf of your patients with insurance companies, that's about as holistic as it gets. So mm-hmm. help us understand that, because your routine day must be enormous.
Well, I think it's really important for our families to know that we have their best interests at heart, you know, and we're going to, you know, they get so upset that they, you know, they don't understand. And I'm just like, don't worry, we're going to fight it. We're going to keep fighting it, and we're going to appeal it until we get what we think is going to be the right thing for your child. So you just got to sit tight and have faith that, you know, it's going to happen. You know, your child will get on an insulin pump, and hopefully before that 6-month mark, because they came up with it. I don't know who made up this rule. It doesn't scientifically make any sense. It's not evidence-based practice.
Not at all.
For sure. You know,
it's like the debate between generic and brand drugs.
It's just really, you know, it's important, because they get so stressed out, and that's unhealthy. And, you know, and certainly, you know, like when a child sees their parents so stressed out, that makes them, they don't feel secure. No. They're not sure what to think. And so, you know, we really want to make sure that we're helping the parents, that we're helping the kids, that the kids see that their parents, you know, they've got this, we've got their back. And you know, it's like, We're in this together. We're really in this together.
Mm-hmm. Peggy, could you give our listeners just a little bit of an insight as to what were some of your challenges during COVID? Because I know you were getting introduced to telemedicine in real time. And, you know, it was something you needed to learn yourself, your staff needed to learn. And then, of course, you needed to be able to figure that out with the physicians and the patient. Could you just speak a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It seemed that, you know, in all the years I've been with my institution for about 19 years, and in almost all those years, the COVID year of 2020 seemed to be the most newly diagnosed that we've had. And there is a lot of research and studies and articles going on about, you know, diabetes and COVID. What we had to do when these kids were sick in the hospital with COVID, we were doing telehealth. So we were doing video education to these families, especially if the child or the parent had COVID, because we're talking about hours at a time of education. And so we had to do this virtually. So it was a virtual platform of education, which actually turned out to be very, very successful. And we have very close follow-up with phone calls, and we can keep doing this virtual education until that family felt secure enough to be able to go home and do the skills that's needed to get done in order for their child to be safe.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, basically, you have a lot of information here that I want our viewers out there to write in to frankabouthealth102@gmail.com for any questions that could be forwarded to Peggy or even Phyllis herself. Also, for you watching this on Facebook at this time, by all means, send your comments and questions, and we could definitely address them. But it seems as though we're about to end the show. But not without showing Peggy at her best.
Well, before you do that, I know we're coming to the end. I just sincerely, Peggy, as a colleague, I just want to thank you.
Yes.
You know, what you do for these children and what you do for their families and the quality of life you offer them, it is the finest of nursing.
Yes.
It's the finest of nursing, the most challenging, and you make such a great difference. And I can't say enough about you, and thank you for sharing all of your challenges. And I'm so very glad your mother said you needed to become a nurse, because that's how we met. But I think we should also, you know, be able to share that, you know, behind mom's back, you know, the dancer and the actress lives. And she has a full life and, you know, a very enjoyable life. And she not only cares for people, but she entertains as well.
So, Sam, sign us off for this episode of Frank About Health with Peggy at her best. And then we will stay tuned for the 6 o'clock hour when my next guest, Sally Kalksma, and I will be talk about mindfulness right here on Frank About Health. Thank you always, Phyllis. I'll be in touch with you later on. And Peggy, you and I will definitely have a meeting in a couple hours to say how wonderful the show was, because it was. Thanks again. And Sam, take it away. All right.
It puts me in a place where I'm so happy and I'm so out there and I forget everything. And I have the biggest smile on my face. Not everybody finds something that they really, really enjoy. Some people are still looking for that and searching for, like, where's that place that makes them just who they are? Too many times we get lost in, you know, being a mom or taking care of your work life. People have a hard time to find that balance. And when you have something that you're very passionate about, it's easier to find that balance. You're like, okay, there's a time for relaxation, there's a time for play, there's a time for work, there's a time for everything, and it's important to make sure that individuals find that time and make it quality.
Awesome.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Thank you, Peggy. Thank you so much.
Business owner. Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you on edge? Hey, we live in challenging, edgy times, so let's lean in. I'm Sandra Bargeman, the host of The Edge of Every Day, which airs each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc. Tune in live with me and my friends and colleagues as we share stories and perspectives about pushing boundaries and exploring our rough edges. That's The Edge of Every Day on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Uninformed about menopause and how it impacts on your life? Hi, I'm Pat Duckworth, women's health strategist and host of the Hot Women Rock radio show, empowering women leaders at menopause. Join me every Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. UK time on talkradio.nyc for interviews with inspirational women who will share their top tips to rock your world.
In a post-COVID world, you may have many unanswered questions regarding your health. Are you looking to live a healthier lifestyle? Do you have a desire to learn more about mental health and enhance your quality of life? Or do you just want to participate in self-understanding and awareness? I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each Thursday, I will tackle these questions and work to enlighten you. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will be Frank About Health to advocate for all of us.
Howdy, I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.